Hi there, my name's Jeremy Thomas, and I am the host of Shed Talks. Shed Talks hopes to be an entertaining, informative podcast that looks at well-being and mental health. And I hope you're going to like it. I'm going to be in conversation with well-known, interesting figures. Now, when it gets to the end of that conversation, don't rush off, because we have got the illustrious, wondrous psychologist Karen Cowan on hand to discuss what's been said and to give us some insight and various tips on what we can do with our mental health. It's all going to be great. Enjoy. Welcome to Shed Talks, episode 15.
Oh, yeah! Like lightning! Everybody was frightening! And the music was soothing! And they all started grooving! And the man at the back said everyone attacked, and it turned into a ballroom blitz! And the girl in the corner said, oh, she's hard and cold!
Extremely special guest this week is a very special person. Some might say a real legend. I think I would. Back in the 1970s, he formed a songwriting partnership
with an extraordinary person called Mike Chapman, called Chinny Chap.
During the ensuing period, they notched up over 50 UK and international top 40 hits. They won 3 Ivor Novello Awards for songwriting, including a Lifetime Achievement Award. He is an outstanding person, an outstanding survivor. He is an ambassador to Bipolar UK. And what's more, he's in the shed right now. Welcome, Nicky Chin.
I'm very thrilled to be here, Jeremy.
Well, let's just go back, you know, to the beginning. It's hard to believe that it was 1945 that you were born. I cannot believe that date, but you were.
I was.
And you were born in London, and yes. You were born into a pretty prosperous, successful family.
I was indeed.
Your father, absolutely. Your father came from Pontypridd in Wales.
Penrhyfer.
What?
Penrhyfer.
Ah. Okay, well, I stand corrected. I suppose I'm a bit of a rugby fan, and Pontypridd used to be very good rugby.
Indeed, very good indeed.
And basically, you were the youngest of 3 boys.
Very much the youngest.
So it was Trevor, who was 10 years older.
Trevor's 10 years older. Geoffrey was 8 years older. Right. It was like being a single child.
Yes, I imagine. And what I thought was interesting in researching this is how successful your brothers have been. In fact, how successful all of you have been.
Yes, indeed. That's very true. Our father was very ambitious for us.
Yeah.
He was very demanding on that level.
Yes. Your early story it's not totally original, but it's nonetheless, you know, not that great to hear about. That, you know, you had a nanny from the get-go who seemed to be there instead of anyone else.
I grew up, it would be fair to say, not really knowing my parents or my brothers. I was with the nanny. She was my family.
Yeah. Well, and then you went to boarding school age six.
Yes.
Great.
Yeah, great. I mean, none of this is what I call healthy. You have a nanny, don't know your family, go to boarding school, don't know your family, because obviously by the time I got there, my brothers who had been to the same school had left.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do not refer to it as a healthy, happy upbringing.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I think is, you know, and it's for you to tell, not me, but I think it's extraordinary about your story is that most people have lots of success and then, you know, come a cropper. And you came a cropper before the success and then had the success. It's quite an unusual thing. But, you know, if we go back to you went to Clifton College and when you were 15, things became very, very dark.
When I was 16.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, oh, very dark indeed. It was as if I'd been in an ordinary room full of daylight and suddenly somebody pulled some black curtains across the windows and I could hardly see. My world just changed.
Just like that?
Like that, yeah. There was no warning. I had no energy. Everything was black. I was extremely low. It felt I was walking through treacle. It just changed. And to a young man of 16, it was very, very frightening.
Yes.
I had no idea what had happened to me.
Yeah, very sure. Frightening. So you got diagnosed. I mean, you know, you
well,
were diagnosed.
Well, the first thing was a very bright teacher. I say bright because people didn't think in those in terms of mental illness in those days. And he said, there's something very wrong with this boy. And I was sent to the school doctor, who in turn sent me to a psychiatrist.
Right.
I always have a giggle about this because the psychiatrist was called Dr. Early. but by the time I got to him, it was too late. He diagnosed me with depression.
Yes.
Because that was the symptom at the time. And it was decided that I couldn't stay at school because I wasn't well enough.
Right.
So I went back to London and I saw another psychiatrist, a Harley Street psychiatrist, who also diagnosed me with depression.
Yeah.
But about 3 months later, I went high. I went manic.
Meaning what, Nicky?
Oh, I started rushing about. I didn't sleep. I was talking fast. I couldn't sit still. And what money I had, I was out there spending it on Elvis Presley records. I bought everything he'd ever made. And it was a compulsion to spend. It wasn't like people go out shopping, oh, I have Elvis' latest record. It was a complete compulsion to spend, which is a big symptom of hypomania.
Yes.
Very big symptom. I obviously presented these symptoms to the psychiatrist. I didn't really have to present them. He saw them.
Yeah.
And then asked me various questions and whatever. And it was then he said to me, I'm going to revise my original diagnosis of depression. And you have manic depression.
Right, right.
And I was like, well, what's that? And he explained it to me as best he could. Even at that young age, it was good to have a diagnosis. It was good to have a label.
Yes.
Because I knew I wasn't that. I knew I had an illness.
Yeah, yeah.
And that told me I wasn't crazy.
Yes.
And I thought to myself, maybe I was going crazy. I was also able to tell my family, my friends, I have a condition.
Yeah.
I have an illness. I'm not just going nuts.
But that was surely quite some difference to tell your family that in the early 60s compared to...
Oh, very much so. it at least it put an end to pull yourself together.
Yes.
Because all I had heard for months.
Yeah.
It was nice to hear that stop.
Yes. Because
no one can tell you to pull yourself together when you have been diagnosed by a doctor who knows what he's talking about. So the pull yourself together stopped.
Yeah. But surely the problem, I guess, I don't know, was that there were probably various people going, well, we do not talk about that because that is very dodgy indeed.
Very much so. I mean, my parents stopped the put yourself together stuff, but at the same time, this was not something to be advertised.
Yeah.
In those days, there was great shame attached
yes.
to mental illness. They didn't want too many people to know they had a son who suffered from mental illness.
Yes, of course, of course. But also, can I just interject, it wasn't like you could pop down, not that the internet existed, but you couldn't pop down to the library and go, oh, could you give me all the books you've got on manic depression? Because as far as I know, there were none.
Correct. There were none. I relied completely on my psychiatrist to guide me through what this was.
Yeah. So what happened?
What happened was from that high, I got very depressed again and was taken into hospital.
Right.
It was a dreadful place. It was called All Saints. It was a national health hospital in the Elephants and Castle.
Ooh.
God alone knows when it was built, but it seemed very old to me.
14th century.
Was it?
No, probably.
And I heard people screaming at night. Hmm. You know, I'm 17 years old by this stage. It was horrific experience.
Yeah.
Horrific. I was put to sleep, actually.
They had yes.
this thing called narcosis treatment, which was very fashionable. Basically, woken up to eat and have a bed bath and be carted off to have electric shock treatment, which again was, I call ECT, the jewel in the crown of psychiatry in those days. Automatic. Give him ECT.
Yes. I mean, that must have been, the whole thing must have been a pretty grim. I mean, this is an understatement. Grim experience.
It was very grim. It was ghastly. It was frightening.
Mm.
And I remember thinking, because I had no other experiences to base it on, I will never, ever get better. I was convinced I would never get better. This was it. A life sentence.
Yes. Well, of course, then that is one of the feelings of, manic depression and the depressive side is that that's actually what does happen, isn't it? You think,
Oh, yes.
I'm never going to get better anyway. So
absolutely. I always say depression has deaf ears when it comes to anything positive.
Yes, of course. Of course. Yeah. Well, later on, I definitely want to get into a more expansive description of manic depression and bipolar. Talk us through, just press the fast forward button a little bit. I'm not sure if it was your girlfriend at the time who introduced you to the members of the Darbo family who introduced you.
I was going out with a girl called Anne, and she was a model. She knew this guy who was the cousin of Mike Darbo, who was the lead singer in Manfred Mann.
Yes.
I showed him some lyrics and he went, I love these. Mike at the time was working on the movie There's a Girl in My Suit with Peter Sellers and Goldie Hawn.
Yes.
Doing the songs and the score. And he said, I got to meet this guy. I love this stuff. So I turn up at Mike's house. I'm very nervous, to say the least.
Yeah.
I get met by his beautiful model wife, Maggie London. We sit down and we have a cup of tea. And as I say, I'm very nervous. I mean, this is getting thrown in the deep end for me.
Yeah, well, from nowhere.
Yeah. And then Mike said, do you want to start doing some work? And I went,
blimey.
Okay. So I pulled up one of the lyrics and we start. On one of the lyrics, he didn't change a word. And that was song called Arabella Cinderella. Then we started working on a song called Miss Me in the Morning. The next thing I know, both songs are in the movie.
In the Girl in My Suit.
Yeah, and I'm at the premiere, would you believe?
Well, I'm surprised you didn't go completely bonkers, but I shouldn't say that.
It was marvellous. This was a brave new world.
But there must have been a fantastic feeling of validation, of sort of, yay, I'm a good guy in my own right. And
yeah, it was fantastic. It was a wonderful validation of everything I'd done. What I hadn't worked out, because I was far too green, that this was not going to earn me a lot of money unless the record, the single that Mike Darbo made, was a hit.
Yeah.
Which it wasn't.
Yes.
So
that was coming down to earth.
It didn't earn me a lot, but it did get me on the ladder.
Yeah. And the next thing you know, you're in a nightclub and somebody says, that waiter over there is quite a good writer. And you meet Mike Chapman.
Yes, it wasn't quite that way round.
Okay.
I took the Mike Darbo single into the club and gave it to the DJ. Mike saw me do that and went up to the DJ and said, who's he?
Right.
He said he's a songwriter. And Mike then came up to me. I was sitting at a table with a girlfriend and said, you're a songwriter. And I said, yeah, yeah. And he said, well, so am I. And I went, oh, good. Okay. Two of us. And we got to know each other over the coming weeks. Every now and again, he'd give me a free drink.
He's Australian.
He was Australian, yes.
Was he very Australian or quite Australian?
No, he wasn't. Mike has a way of, wherever he moves, he manages to adopt the accent.
Oh, right.
Now he talks like an American, but then he talked like an Englishman. He said to me, what do you think if we got together and wrote? And I'm not the kind of guy who thinks, well, he's a waiter, whatever. I went, yes, absolutely. Come round to my place on Saturday morning.
And off you went. Gosh.
Mike came round and we got going.
Right. And not that the rest is history. I mean, you know, I think what's always interesting that people make such a mistake when they think about writers in music that, you know, so many people I know go, well, sit on a bus and they work it out, don't they? And then they go and put it down in the studio and that's it. And yeah. I know in the Chinny Chat situation, there was a lot of hard graft and
a lot of hard graft, a lot of turndown while we were running around town seeing publishers. And it was at that point I said to Mike, we've got to see somebody who knows a hit.
Yeah.
We have to see somebody who is making records,
yes,
a producer. I took somebody's secretary out to lunch, gave her a few glasses of wine, and got Mickey Mouse's home phone number. I did not want to call him at the office because there was a chance I wouldn't get through, wouldn't call back.
Yeah.
I didn't want to go through that.
So I
called him at home at 9 o'clock at night. I speak to Mickey? And Mickey speaking. I said, my name is Nicky Chin. You won't know me. I write with Mike Chapman and we write hits. And he said, do you? I said, yes, we do. And he said, what would you like me to do about it? I said, I think it'd be a good idea if you saw us. And Mickey being Mickey, like all great men, does not pass on and on. He said, how will 11:30 tomorrow morning suit you?
Brilliant.
Up we went at 11:30 the next day, walked into his office. There were four people in his office in the same room.
Who were they?
There was his brother, Dave Most, promotion man, the accountant, and then, if you please, Peter Grant, manager of Led Zeppelin. So you've got the biggest rock manager in the world sitting next to arguably the biggest pop producer in the world.
Maybe we should pause there and just say, because not everyone knows who Mickey Most was. I mean, he was a huge Svengali of pop music.
Massive.
He came from South Africa, I think, right?
English, but went to South Africa to work.
Oh, right. Okay.
Had an act called the Most Brothers, but it wasn't his brother.
And he formed Rack Records, R-A-K.
He formed Rack Records. He started off in 63. His first record was House of the Rising Sun.
Oh, right.
The first record he ever made. yeah. went to number one around the world. Then he had The Animals, Donovan, Herman's Hermits, Jeff Beck, Hot Chocolate,
yeah.
Rod Stewart, on and on.
No, I mean, he definitely Midas touch, and he just had it, didn't he? I mean,
oh, absolutely.
But so, in a very interesting way.
Oh, yes. And a great guy.
Yeah.
He turned out to be my best friend, but not at that stage. So I walk into this office. I'm pretty green, to say the least. And there is Mickey Mouse and Peter Grant. And I think, what on earth has hit me? What's going on here? So we play some songs to Mickey. Mickey had a habit, quite rightly, actually, if halfway through the first chorus he didn't like it, he'd just go, don't make it. And that was it. So I had, don't make it, don't make it, don't make it, don't make it.
And then?
And I'm thinking, well, it really is time to get out of here. But we've got one more song, I said. And we didn't have a tape of it. So Mike said, do you have a guitar? Mickey said, yes. And Mike proceeded to play and sing. And halfway through the first chorus, Mickey goes, stop. Right, I'm thinking, I'm out of here as yeah. fast as I can get. Which one of you called me last night and told me you wrote hits? And I said, I did. And he said, well, you were right. And I went, oh, my Lord, I've just been told by Mickey I was right. We do write hits. And Mickey said, yeah, that's a hit. And it was a song called Tom Tom Turnaround.
All right.
Which, in fact, he went on to record himself with New World. They'd won a talent show. I've forgotten which one. And he went on to record it himself with New World. And it went to number six. In the meantime, we had recorded Funny Funny with Sweet, which had gone to number 14. Then we had Coco with Sweet, which went to number two. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we are on a roll.
Yeah.
And it all started with Mickey saying, yeah, you write hits. That gave us a lot of confidence, of course.
Of course, yeah. But and also having those early hits, I mean, goodness, I mean, that must have been great.
Oh, yeah, enormous. In those days, the chart came out on a Tuesday. And I've always said since then, you go to bed on a Monday night, this is with your first hit, you go to bed on a Monday night and no one's ever heard of you. Suddenly, 10 o'clock on Tuesday morning, everybody's beginning to hear about
you. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It is literally overnight success.
So, very interesting. I mean, just to remind ourselves, this is, you know, what we're about on this podcast is looking at people's careers and their mental health. So I got to try and rein that back in a bit. But just to say to you, I mean, I know we're about to go into like 8, 9, 10 years of sensational success. Question, you know, you're on a, you know, white water raft, but it didn't throw you off beam at all mentally. You were okay.
Oh yes, it did. That did. My manic depressive condition,
yes,
which as we know these days is called bipolar.
Yeah.
Has been since 1980. Oh, that reared its ugly head within about, I don't know, two and a half years.
Yeah.
I was in hospital.
Was that on the depressive side, Nicky? Or was
well,
it
I went high first.
Right. Oh, okay.
Yeah. I went into a hypermanic phase.
Yeah.
Very creative, very expensive. Because by that time I had money to spend.
Yes. So how did that manifest?
Two or three things. I went out and I ordered two Rolls Royces.
Oh, really? Just the two.
Bearing in mind, I already had one. Mickey Most heard about this. And he knew the dealer. It was Jack Barclay in Barclay Square. And he knew the dealer because he bought his Rolls Royces from there. And he went in to see them and said, look, my friend isn't well. So cancel those orders because he doesn't really mean it. And if he does mean it, he'll come back and get them anyway. So
yeah.
They canceled the orders. I bought a huge amount of clothes and everything. And then I came back one day and tried to turn my bathroom into a discotheque.
Gosh.
I bought flashing lights. put a record turntable in there.
Brilliant.
I actually invited people to come, but no one came.
Oh.
I think they all knew what was going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, come to my disco.
Yeah, yes, yes, they went, thanks.
Those were the sort of things that happened. They were off the wall.
But you were...
They really were.
Yeah, but you were hospitalised with that one in the end.
Well, yeah, I got depressed. And I was hospitalized this time, thank God, in a private hospital. But it was the same treatment. It was narcosis, ECT.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. It hadn't changed by then.
How is this all going down with the family? Because you've got two things going on, haven't you? You've got, hello, I'm suddenly being very successful. I've got hit records all the time. And, I'm also going back into hospital. Were people sort of going, oh, my God, Nicky? Or was it not like that?
Well... The family, they didn't know what to make of me, actually, because one has to understand that when I was 17 and got ill and got ill again and again, basically, I think I was written off.
Yeah.
And it was more, well, what the hell are we going to do with him? Well, let's get him into the family business. That way we can control things and he'll be okay.
Yeah.
You know, and we'll sort of promote him now and again. Which they, as I say, was overpromoting. So when I did actually become successful, I think everyone was a bit puzzled and surprised and didn't think it would last. It was like...
Flash in the pan.
Okay, you're a songwriter. What are you going to do for a day job?
Yeah, when are you going to get a proper job?
So when I went into hospital, it was, well, here we go again. I kept the family at bay a great deal more than I used to. I was independent. I was paying for myself and my own hospitalization as opposed to anybody else paying for it. And I was more independent. Didn't let everybody come and see me all the time.
Right.
Mickey Most was incredibly supportive.
He'd really became a big friend.
Oh, yeah. I became my best friend in the world, without a doubt. I was very close to Mike Chapman. But Mike was more of the pull yourself together kind.
Yes.
Mickey wasn't.
Yeah.
So Mickey would come and visit me and be very supportive. And Mike would want me back writing as soon as possible. So pull yourself together.
Yeah. Well, that's maybe the old Aussie coming out, you know.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But I know that, I mean, the nice thing in this story is that you remain close throughout his life. And you gave the eulogy at his funeral, I think.
I did indeed.
Which is a big deal, you know.
For me, it was a very big deal. We loved each other. We didn't just like each other.
Yeah.
We loved each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very important point, though, to make about your life, that you had him in your life. Because he was obviously a real, real support and somebody you trusted a lot.
Trusted him 101%.
Yeah.
Yeah, with my life.
When you know, you're prone to the old bout of bipolar, manic depression, whatever you want to call it, depression, it's so great to have someone in your life who is a go-to person.
Oh, absolutely. And he was the go-to person. The friendship was unconditional. He was my mentor at the beginning and then turned into my dearest friend. He was a great man.
No, absolutely massive. Did anybody else, I mean, I don't want you to say anything that compromises you, but did anybody in your stable, in the Chinny Chap stable, Mud, Sweet, Susie Quattro, all of the gang that you had, and there were a lot of them. I mean, did it ever happen that anybody had any mental health problems?
Well, Brian, the lead singer of Sweet, died of alcoholism.
Really?
And alcoholism is a mental illness.
Yes, it is, yeah.
You know, a lot of people think, oh, alcoholism is self-induced.
No, that's rubbish.
Yeah. The person's got themselves to blame. It's a lot of rubbish. It is a mental illness just like bipolar.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
They can't stop drinking. Brian drank himself to death, so he had a mental illness. Funnily enough, of all the bands I ever worked with, Brian was the one who became a close friend, and that really? May be no coincidence.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was a great front man, wasn't he? I mean,
he was a great front man. He really, really was a fabulous front man.
So just going back now, I mean, because, you know, you had all of this success with Sweet, with Mudd, with Susie Quattro. Susie Quattro must have been quite young at the time.
Susie, well, she was quite young, early 20s, I suppose.
Right. Oh, I thought she was younger.
Mickey found Susie in Detroit. And again, Mickey, he had a great talent. She was in a band with her sisters. She wasn't even the lead singer.
Yeah.
He spotted her. Many years ago, Mike Leander, who wrote and produced Carrie Glitter, amongst other things, said to me, if you lined 100 people up on the left and 100 people up on the right, and Mickey Mose came along and said, it's the 77th on the left who's a star, he'd be right. He had a wonderful eye and a wonderful ear.
He was that good.
And he said to Susie, come to London, look me up. And he didn't commission, so if you come to London.
Yeah.
And she did, obviously, based on that. And he called me and said, would you and Mike take Susie over and do what you do? So we sat down and wrote a song specifically for Susie, because that's the way we worked with our acts.
Yeah.
We didn't write a song and say, oh, Sweet, Mud, you know, they were always tailored.
Yeah.
And we wrote a song for Susie, went into the studio with her, recorded Can the Can, and that went to one. So
just like that,
it went to number one.
Was it really that straightforward?
It was that straightforward.
How extraordinary.
If writing a number one is ever straightforward, but it was that straightforward.
But I mean, to me, it's extraordinary that you didn't know her really, and that you go, okay, this is what we sort of thought.
No, we did know her. She hung out at Rack in the day quite often, and right. We'd go into Rack. So we had got to know her.
Okay.
We didn't know her intimately, but we knew her.
Right.
Yeah, I took her in the studio, and we came out of the studio. We played it to Mickey, and Mickey said, speed it up just very, very slightly. Just the master tape, the quarter inch.
Yeah.
Speed it up very slightly. He said, I think that'll help. We did that. Bang, number one.
Wow. Well, she must have been very chirpy.
Great feeling.
Yeah. And you had loads of hits with hers.
Oh, yeah. We had a lot of hits.
Devilgate Drive.
We had a lot of hits with everyone we worked with, actually. We always stayed with them. But, oh, we had a lot of hits with Susie. Yes, a lot.
Amazing. Well, look, we're just going to move all this on. Because, we could spend at least 2 hours talking about that period of time.
Yes.
Which would be very nice. But we're not going to do that because we're going to talk about other things. I'm pressing the fast forward, okay? And I say this on the basis that I personally really admire what you did, you know, because there was really a lot of crafting going on and you really made those songs, those records, as great as they could be possibly be. And I think that's, I know it might sound obvious to other people, but I understand that.
Oh, yes. We worked very hard on our songs. We didn't settle for something. We never said, oh, well, that's good enough. Can't think of anything else.
Were you both?
We were very, very conscious of the competition. You know, hey, we better be good because other people are good.
Yeah. I mean, because we're at the end of the 70s now. What did you think of ABBA?
Oh,
Hello, great. Baby.
Oh, great. There was no denying ABBA. I mean, major, major talent. Look. Back then, none of us thought about lasting. None of us thought about 40 years' time.
Yeah.
We thought about next week. You know, what will the chart be next week? None of us, I never said, well, ABBA will be around in 40 years' time. But then I never said, Nicky and Mike will be around in 40 years. But I was asked in interviews what my ambition was, and I did always say to write a standard. Little did I know that I'd already done it.
Yeah. Anyway, so here's a quote that you said in an interview, and this is relating to the end of the 70s, okay? We did the expensive cars, the clubbing, the drinking too much, and maybe not treating people as nicely as you should. For a time, we thought we were God's gift to the music business because, for a while, all the evidence said that we were. What do you think? Yeah, I mean, is that? Do you feel that's true? Yeah, you do.
Without a shadow of a doubt, it did seem true. I now realize that nobody is God's gift to anything. But at the time, young, it's very easy to get arrogance, money, success. It brings power.
Yes.
And success also brings people telling you how great you are.
Yes. And you start
and
to believe it.
To believe.
Yeah.
And I look back, I have no problem admitting my levels of arrogance.
Yeah.
I don't like it when I think of it because I'm the opposite now.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I understand it. It's impossible, I think, not to.
Yeah. Anyway, so there's a big change about to happen in your story, and that is called America, Los Angeles, Beverly Hills. Mike zooms, says, I'm going to go and work in America. See you soon. Bye. And you go, oh, hold on a minute. I think I'll come to America.
Yeah, I waited 4 years.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. We still had a very big business around the world.
Right.
Very big. And I think if I had gone at the same time and deserted that business, things would have begun to maybe go wrong. I would travel to America every 5 or 6 weeks.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah. Stay at the Beverly Hills Hotel and work with Mike.
Right.
I worked at his home. So in actual fact, for the next 4 years or so, I was commuting.
Right, okay.
I loved it, actually. It was great fun. I was at the Beverly Hills Hotel, pull lots of American girls, have a ball, and work very hard at the same time.
Right, okay. But it sort of, it went into a slightly weirder one, didn't it? When he sort of said, like, I'm going to do more production, you know, with Blondie and, you know, people like that.
Yes.
And sort of went off on his own. And you'd by then moved there, I think.
I had moved there, yes. I moved in 1979.
Right. And you bought Paul Newman's house, I think.
I bought Paul Newman's house, yes.
Blimey.
In a slightly manic stage.
Yes.
Looking back, I didn't need Paul Newman's house. It was a bit big.
Yes.
But I was a bit manic at the time. I thought, oh, this is marvellous. And we'll have 37 children. Well, in actual fact, I didn't want children.
But this was...
That was mania.
You were going to have the children with somebody specific, though.
Pardon?
You were going to have the children with the person you married.
Oh, yes.
Who was that then?
Yeah, I was, but we didn't have any.
Her name was Jill?
Yeah, her name was Jill, and she was born and bred in Beverly Hills.
Ah.
That is not a good recipe for marriage.
Yes, I think we know what you're saying here.
Yeah, it was a bad marriage.
Right, okay.
And in fact, I left. After 2 years.
Yes.
Got up one morning, I packed a case, I called the airline, get me a first class ticket, and I got out.
Right.
It was as simple as that. Couldn't stay any longer.
But there was a whole sort of thing, wasn't there, at that point? Things had gone a bit pear-shaped. I'm now referring to the record company that was set up.
Oh, yes.
Dreamworld.
Well, we formed this record company, Dreamland Records, with Robert Stigwood,
yes,
who paid us a lot of money to do it, a lot of money. And we proceeded to get it 100% wrong, signed all the wrong artists. We couldn't have done it worse, really.
But why? Why was that? Your judgment was just completely off, and you were signing people for the wrong reasons.
Off. We were writers and producers.
Yeah.
We weren't record company.
Yes.
A lot of the writing stopped because Mike wanted the acts to write their own stuff.
Yes.
Which I knew was dangerous.
Yeah.
Because the one thing we were great at and better than pretty much everybody else was writing songs.
Right.
And all of a sudden we're saying to the acts, you write the song. Didn't work. Yeah, just didn't work.
So by then, it then went really started to go pear-shaped with Mike Chapman.
Yeah, totally pear-shaped. Pretty much everything went wrong. Yeah, it couldn't have gone more wrong.
Yeah. So
in reality.
So, Nicky, it put you in a really dodge position because you were then, the marriage had gone wrong. The partnership, which was like a marriage, had gone wrong. The record label had gone wrong. And America had gone wrong. And so, yeah. And you came back.
I had multiple divorces.
Yeah, yeah. Well, multiple I mean, it's all super traumatic, isn't it? And I'm amazed you made it back. You made it back to the, you know, to the UK.
I'm amazed I made it back.
Anyway, so you came back to London, did a bit of work with one or two people, but you said another quote, you said there was no way I was going to recapture that chemistry. And for a long time, I didn't really feel like working at all. And that sounds like it all coincided with some bad depressions.
Yes, yeah, I didn't really feel like working. The people I was working with, I knew were not in Mike's class, not in the same league.
Yeah.
And within a certain amount of time, I got ill.
Yeah.
Unsurprisingly.
Yeah, well, I mean, it looks like you're in hospital at 88, 90, 92.
Yeah, absolutely. Long periods of time.
Were they all 80% depressive, depression?
My illnesses, my condition has always tended to be a lot more low than high.
Yeah.
My lows are very often preceded by a high.
Yeah.
In the middle of a low, I could get high, which is very confusing to everybody, the doctors and me, because got to bring me down from the high. Of course, bringing me down brings me into depression. But then what goes up must come down anyway.
Yes.
So I'm predominantly depressed, but I get my highs as well, which tend, as I said, very confusing to everyone. Yeah.
Well, you'd managed to eradicate alcohol for, you know, as in stopping for 6 months and sort of right.
Oh,
again.
Yeah, but I've eradicated that. Oh, virtually. I mean, now I might drink a few glasses of wine a month.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, nothing. But my intake went down big time in 1985.
Yeah. Prior to that, you were a big Scotch whiskey
drinker. I was a big Scotch drinker, yes. Very big.
Yeah.
Too big.
So, question, and I've got the privileged information here. When were you prescribed lithium?
71, around then.
Oh, really?
I was sent for a second opinion, and this second opinion gave everybody lithium. If it had been an ostrich walked into his office, he'd have given them lithium.
Yes. Okay. Well, look, hang on. We get to... Yeah, well, I mean, it looks like you're in hospital at 88, 90, 92.
Yeah.
We get to 1994, 95, and that is a very good period for you.
Absolutely. Well, in 93, I went to see this new psychiatrist.
Yeah.
Man called Eric Shaw, a South African, probably the best psychiatrist I've ever seen. And he said to me, I'm looking at your history, and I have to tell you, I don't believe lithium works for you.
Yeah.
I said, you mean I've been taking it all these years and it doesn't work? And he said to me, do you think it works? I said, well, no, looking at my history, it doesn't.
Yeah.
They took me off it and put me on to two medications, lamotrigine and valproate. They are both anti-epileptic,
yes.
But they have been discovered to work for bipolar.
Yeah.
So that's what I went on to.
And it did work for you.
And it did work. So
I think that's really fantastic. But we should say, as a sort of government health warning, I know you feel this, that lithium does work for some people.
I have to tell you, let me qualify everything I have said by saying lithium didn't work for me.
Mm.
I know people for whom it has been dramatically successful.
I think you're quite right. It's actually what works for Fred doesn't necessarily work for Ted.
That's right.
And like Valparate and all those things, it's like if anyone's listening to this, do not think, oh, I must go and take that. It's actually to check it all out is the thing
and
see what works.
Absolutely. So in 1993, that happened. You referred to 1994. I went into analysis. I was in an analytic group. We met twice a week. That's heavy going.
And how long did you do that for?
I was in that group for 9 years.
Wow.
You know, people don't come and go as much in an analytic group as they do in ordinary therapy group.
Yes.
I mean, some people came and went, but I was in the group for 9 years. There were people there who were for 5 years with me. Big commitment.
And?
It helped change my life.
Really?
Oh, without
Why?
A doubt.
Why, Nicky?
Well, when I went into, I realized it, I hadn't emotionally grown up. I was still a child in many ways. I might have been 49, but I was still a child. I grew up in that group. I became self-aware. I began to understand how I worked, how I tip, as well as the rest of the world. And I think it's probably safe to say that it saved my life, because I don't think Wonderful. I would be here today without having gone into that analytic group. I really don't.
I think that's great. And I think the thing is that, I mean, not that this is a sort of self-help podcast, but I think, again, for people listening to this, it's a great bit of hope there that people should check out all sorts of things. You know, it's not just because you get to, you think, oh, I'm 49, that's it. You checked it out. You lifted up the stone and went, blimey.
Yes.
I'll do that.
I will go so far as to say, Jeremy, that I don't think there is such a thing as not being able to get well from mental illness. The question is, how badly does the individual want to?
Yes.
I desperately wanted to.
I understand that. And I think that you make a good point about that.
So I went into analysis. That started to begin with was very hard. I always say I strip myself naked, emotionally and psychologically.
Yeah.
And I became unwell as a result. I didn't go in the hospital.
Yeah.
Then around that time, I met somebody.
Yes.
A woman called Vanessa, who I ultimately ended up marrying.
Fantastic.
And that would not have happened if I wasn't getting well and opening myself up. It wouldn't have happened.
Yes. So I think it's a very important point to make. And I think it's so great to hear that you met somebody who I think sounded really great and was, you know, really wonderful to you. And you were doubtless wonderful to
sensational. Best person I've ever met.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Fantastic. And how long were you together?
Unfortunately, she passed away in November.
Yes, I did know that.
She was much younger than me, 16 years younger. So it was not something I had originally been expecting.
No.
But as I am a great believer in honesty, and not only that, a great believer in acknowledging mental health or bad mental health.
Yes.
When it exists, Vanessa was an alcoholic. And to me, alcoholism is a mental illness as much as bipolar is. Again, we go back to how badly does the person want to get well?
Yeah.
And I'm afraid Vanessa didn't want to get well badly enough. She had her demons. She had been diagnosed with a physical condition called Guillain-Barré, which is a neurological illness, which affects the body, the limbs. She was a rider. She used to go rowing. A very, very active person.
Yeah.
She was unable to do all of these things. Her life was taken away from her virtually overnight. It was something that she was unable to bear. And I understand that. So yes. In answer to how long were we together, 28 great years.
Well, that's 28 great years is great.
But, you know, 28 years, that's a pretty good long time. She changed my life.
Brilliant. And I'm sure you did hers, you know.
I did. You know,
was she a lot of fun?
Oh, Vanessa was this massive personality. Funny, very, very beautiful to look at, as it happens. Very talented. A wonderful cook. Wonderful eye for decor. Our homes looked wonderful by the time she'd finished with them. Just all round special.
No, I think that's great. I really do. And, you know, I think we just to remember all, you know, I know it's cliche, but we have to remember all the, you know, all the good times.
Without a doubt.
Well, listen, I'm sorry to hear that you only have one Rolls Royce or not three. But we've come to the end of this section and we're going to do the life jackets very soon. Yeah. But I thought I'd just give you a couple of minutes because I know it what's interesting about you, Nicky, is that you kept going in your life. And despite we've in some ways underplayed some of the, you know, some of the serious things that's happened for you being in hospital. And it's not,
oh, yes.
It's not like a bloody health bomb.
No,
I mean, we know. And you know what I mean? So you've survived, but you haven't just coasted off to Florida. And I think it's wonderful that you've done that psychoanalysis and that you kept going. And you're still keeping going because you now are an ambassador for Bipolar UK and a speaker. I don't know if you want to say a tiny bit about that.
Oh, yes. Working. I this is about 3-4 years ago. I called up Bipolar UK and I made an appointment with the chief executive, Simon Kitchen. And I went to see him and I said, I'd like to do some work for you. And I thought, I want to put something back. Anyway, this developed beyond my wildest dreams and their wildest dream. And I've spoken now twice at the Houses of Parliament, as you know, you were there. But I did a speech a few weeks ago in Guildford. Yeah. I've got 3 or 4 more dates lined up. I write a lot of stuff that goes on the Bipolar UK site. Right. I think I've got about 15 pieces there. Okay. So the great thing about all this is, A, I'm doing a lot of good, I believe, for other sufferers of bipolar, because my message is always positive. It's, I may have been there, but hey, I got through it and I'm here today. And the other thing is, it allows me to write.
Yeah.
And I love writing. As my brother said to me, you've got a new career. And wow. I absolutely love it.
Well, I think that's great, and I'm you know, I'm very pleased, and that's how we did meet. So that is, you know, what we call tip top and tidy. And just so that anybody doesn't understand, we said it before, but you know, bipolar is the same thing as manic depression, because it's amazing how many people don't understand that one. But that's fair enough.
Well, it's very simple. It was in 1980 that people decided, quite rightly, by the way, that manic and mania sounded a little bit too alike. Somebody actually once called me a maniac depressive. So they weren't wrong. The association wasn't that good. And I think bipolar is a much more civilized. It is the two ends of the poles. Much more civilized way of putting it.
Right. Okay. Well, I will discuss that.
Yeah.
So, Nicky, if I asked you, which I'm actually asking you, what are the warning signs of a manic phase in bipolar? What would you tell us? What would I say?
There's no warning sign for me going into the hypermanic state. My first warning is hypermania, when I feel elated, euphoric, I want to spend money, which I always do, can be very costly. I think I can do anything, conquer the world. That's my warning.
Right.
So I go straight into a hypermanic state.
Okay.
That's my warning, but I'm going to go more manic.
Okay. So you're going to guess that's just stage one.
And that's the time for me to call my psychiatrist.
Right. Okay. And if you don't call the psychiatrist, then it's stage two.
I go crazy. I go into a manic stage where I can't stop talking. I'm talking 3 times as fast. I can't sit still. I can't sleep. I can't do anything normal when I'm properly manic.
Is the libido functioning on overdrive?
The libido really is functioning more on overtime when I'm hypermanic.
Right.
When I'm manic, the libido doesn't really care.
And is there... Is it then a question that it's all bets are off anyway? It's all too late. You can't stop. The train is screeching through the platform, as it were.
all bets are off, except for one thing. Actually, all bets are on, because it's a certainty I'm going to get depressed. So all bets are off while I'm manic, because anything can happen. Where the bets are on, odds on, in fact, is I'm going to get depressed.
Right.
And there's no way around it.
No, but you don't know necessarily know that, or somebody with this.
No, I don't. I think somewhere in the back of mind I do. And the other thing is this, I'm going to be given stuff to bring me down. It's got horrible side effects, twitchy kind of side effects, haloperidol and stuff like that, and nasty side effects, to which they had to give me an antidote. So there's so many medications flying around. The downers bring me down even faster. I'm going to crash. And I think somewhere I do know I'm about to crash. Yes.
Right, right.
There's nothing I can do about it because it's unavoidable.
Okay. Well, you described that. And what would you mean?
Let me just say this. In its own way, mania at that stage is as hellish as depression in a very different way. But when you're climbing the walls, it's not a lot of fun.
Right. And without, I hope, being too nosy or whatever, how did therapy help you deal with all of this, the bipolar side?
Bipolar, in my estimation, and it's generally accepted, bipolar needs a trigger, an emotional, psychological trigger, very often subconscious, very, very often subconscious. And it's all the toxic stuff for me, and for a lot of people, that I bring from my upbringing and haven't sorted out. There's a lot of baggage, emotional and psychological, that triggers the illness for me.
Right.
When I went into analysis, I began to work on that. I kind of came out of denial into the real world, because I've been in denial. I hadn't wanted to face my demons. If I don't face my demons, I don't know my demons. And there were plenty of them. In facing them and talking about them and working on them and working on them and working on them, I made them smaller and smaller and smaller. And the smaller my demons are, the less likely I am to get ill. So therapy, I won't say served as a cure, because I'm not sure there is a cure, but together with medication, really, really leveled things out and made my life much more of a level playing field than it had ever been.
Right.
I'm a huge believer. I do not believe in medication without therapy. I absolutely don't.
Yeah.
Both of those together that helped me sort out my life. I was well for 15 years. I became unwell again 8 years ago. And ever since then, I've been very, very well.
Okay.
I still am in therapy. I do group therapy, which I'm a great believer in, by the way. I think group therapy is more powerful than individual. And I still continue to look after myself in that regard.
Welcome back to Shed Talks. And now we are on one of my favorite sections, Life Jackets. And I'm here with Nikki Chin, and it's all going terribly well. And Nikki, what I'm going to do, because I've got an idea of what your life jackets are, well, possible ones, and I'm going to go for it. So basically, in terms of novels, books, you've given us a few choices. And I think the interesting one is The Godfather, Mario Puzo. Tell me about your thoughts on that.
I read it naturally before the film was made. So I wasn't going in having seen the film. It was just a marvelous book. It was actually ahead of its time. No question about that. And the way it really exposed how the mafia worked, but didn't expose any single body. Although at the time people were saying, well, that character is based on Don whoever.
Yes.
The narrative, it was so original.
Yes.
It really was. And look, it blew the lid off the market, didn't it? I mean, so like hotcakes. It was an enormous book.
What a subject.
Written.
Yeah.
What the subject. Yeah, marvellous.
Do you find that you read for solace or for distraction or to get out of yourself or just for, I mean, a variety of reasons? I mean, looking back and...
I always felt I was reading for enjoyment. I never saw anything deeper than that.
Yeah, no, I know, because some people I know do read because they just like to go. It may be that they read, you know, Ian Rankin, Inspector Rebus, and they want to get out of themselves because they feel fed up and they want to be in another world, science fiction.
Yeah, you know? No, that's not me.
That's not you. Okay, all right. No. Well, that's good. So what you've put, which is interesting, because sometimes people choose poetry and they really go on about modern poets or whatever, and you've put, for poetry and inspirational writer, you've put the First World War poets, Siegfried Sassoon, Rupert Brooke, and Wilfred Owen, who I think is a brilliant poet.
So do I.
I mean,
he
really
didn't write much.
No, well, he wasn't that old, was he? I mean,
no, he wasn't. He didn't write much, but what he wrote was sensational.
Yeah.
Why I got into the First World War poet, I don't actually know. I think I picked something up, Wilfred Owen or whatever. I wrote poetry myself at the time.
Yes.
I went, wow, this is amazing. And then I started to read all of them. And of course, it really does expose the fruitlessness and stupidity of war.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Those World War poets who were all very young and all in the war, they really knew how to expose the stupidity of war. I say the stupidity, the horror of war. But then that's what makes it so unnecessary. They wrote about the horror of war amazingly. They drew pictures.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what I'm interested in with you. Double sword, really. One was their use of language. And for me, particularly Wilfred Owen. I mean, Anthem for Doomed Youth. What passing bells for these who die as cattle? Only the monstrous anger of the guns, only the stuttering rifles, rapid rattle. I mean, you know, he knew what he was doing. I mean,
he knew what he was doing. He knew how to draw pictures.
Yeah.
His sense of alliteration, rapid rifles, rattle. Oh, he knew what he was doing. Absolutely. The guy was unbelievably talented.
Yeah. Okay, so we move on and we go to movies. And I noticed that you had put down E.T. and Rocky, because I think you've got this real commercial... Yeah, get them taste. And I think that's right, isn't it?
I have. But I love tales of overcoming.
Yes.
Odds, if you like, and a victory. E.T., in its own way, very much so. How on earth did he get back? But he did.
Yes.
And Rocky, well, it's the absolute story of the underdog.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, Sylvester Stallone. And...
Which I love, because when I was young, as you know, when we discussed it before, very much the youngest in my family, I got ill. Nobody really knew what they were going to do with me.
Yeah.
You know, what was going to become of me. And yet, against the odds, I was Rocky.
Yeah. You managed to do it, to survive.
Oh, yeah, no, against
the
odds.
Keep coming back,
I was Rocky. Yeah, absolutely.
No, I think that's brilliant. But the film at the top of the list, of course, just to repeat ourselves, is The Godfather.
Yes.
Which certainly is my favourite. But what was it about The Godfather? I mean, if there was one thing.
It was the characters.
Yeah.
I mean, the script was brilliant.
Yeah.
The movie was brilliant. The direction was brilliant. But the characters.
Yeah.
The part that Brando took.
Yeah.
I happen to love Al Pacino. And of course, that was the beginning of his career. The character he took, James Caan's character. I mean, all of the characterizations were fantastic.
Well,
they were all played to a T.
Absolutely. And they were all, I mean, you know, you think Diane Keaton was in that and she almost looked like a minor character. I mean,
yes.
She's good actress.
And they were so real. I mean, you felt this is really what it is like.
Yeah. And, you know, the guy who played, I think he was called Fredo. He was a wonderful actor. He was in Dog Day Afternoon, The Deer Hunter. He's brilliant, actually. He died very, very young, unfortunately.
Yes.
But
Pacino is marvellous.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, yes. They all were. Marvellous.
Marvellous.
So, okay, let's move on now. So here you are. You're looking for the things that are going to keep you afloat. And there's a certain group that seems to get the biggest vote on your thing, which is a minor group called the Beatles.
Yes.
I'm just noticing your song choices, Hey Jude, Strawberry Fields, Penny Lane. And I just wanted to put a word in. I'm going to shut up now. I just wanted to put a word in there for Eleanor Rigby.
Don't I have Eleanor Rigby there?
No, you don't.
Oh, I meant to. You don't have to put a word in for Eleanor Rigby. I couldn't agree with you more. Absolutely. For me, the Beatles, we know what they did. They broke the whole scene wide open. There'd never been anything like them. There never will be. But over the years, I keep on going back to the Beatles. You know, I stop playing them and then I go back. And about 9 months ago, I went back.
Mm.
After 2 or 3 years, maybe more.
Right, yeah.
I'll be honest with you, I was astounded again.
Yes.
I when I listen to the Beatles, I can't even find anything remotely average.
Yeah.
You can't say that about any other act. They don't understand average.
Yeah.
They only understand very, very good or great.
Yeah.
And that's the Beatles. And I will always be astounded with them. They are part of the reason I went and did it, to be honest with you.
Now, Pets, Nicky.
Yes.
I think we've got you. Tell us about Pets or the Pet.
Firstly, I'm a massive animal lover,
right.
Generally. I give to animal charities. I'm an animal lover. They're great. Pets, dogs, absolutely. And German Shepherds in particular.
I think there's one right behind you.
There is, yeah, that's Simba.
Oh.
Simba was a bit of a rescue, actually. Yeah, Vanessa brought him home from work. He became very much a part of our family. And we got another German Shepherd that we call Presley. Presley was brilliant. And they both had great lives and they lived to good ages. I adore dogs. They love you unconditionally.
What is it, excuse me for interrupting, what is it about German Shepherds that you really love?
Oh, they've got a lot of character, a lot of personality, and they're very intelligent. They really, really are. Pardon?
Aren't they quite soppy in places?
They can be. I mean, anybody who's frightened of German Shepherds, and people are, have absolutely no need to be. Yeah, they can be very soppy. But they're very loyal, very loyal. And anybody who tells me dogs don't love, I don't believe.
Well, okay. Well, that's it takes us to our last topic on the list, which is, you know, what you like, you know, as Life Jacket on television. And I'm going to just suggest two things to you that you've said. One is David Attenborough and the other is The Sopranos. A very interesting choice.
Yes. Yeah. Well, actually, I missed out sport because I'm a sports.
Oh,
fanatic.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Fanatic.
What? So everything? Everything?
Almost everything. Yes. Tennis, top of my list. But rugby, cricket, athletics, football, everything. And I went to a rugby playing school, so I'm very into rugby.
Yes.
So I love sport, and I'm a great armchair supporter of Manchester United.
Okay.
The Sopranos was classic. Again, one of the all-time great programs. But the great thing about The Sopranos was they made him so human.
Tony Soprano.
He was this gangster who went to a therapist.
No, that was, I thought that was what was clever, the triangle of him going to the lady therapist.
Oh, yes.
And also, and then the wife, who I thought was very good.
Absolutely. And he'd go to the therapist and then go at the next end and shoot someone. when I talk about David Attenborough, what can you say? There has never been anybody like him. There never will be. His knowledge, that voice.
Yes.
The voice is magic. But his knowledge, his feel, his love of animals. Where he goes, which is all around the world, there's nowhere he hasn't covered. No animal yet. Sensational. The king.
Yeah, and somebody who can cover all sorts of things, you know, whether it's tigers, cheetahs, sharks, whales, chimpanzees.
Absolutely everything. The man's very, very special. Funnily enough, what a lot of people don't know, he was Director General of the BBC.
Was he? I didn't know that.
Yes. Yeah, you go back many years, he ran the BBC.
My goodness. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I know his brother was a famous film director and actor.
Oh, indeed, indeed. Very talented family. But Attenborough is exceptional, exceptional.
Yeah, but I mean, I think, again, just bringing this close, you know, that we're thinking about, you know, mental health and all that stuff. It's great to have some stuff that you reach into the cupboard and you say, I'm going to have a bottle of Attenborough. I'm going swimming and...
And also there's something about mental illness and animals, if you like, that they kind of go together. There's something very soft and empathic about a love of animals. I've had it all my life, and for me, animal. I was watching television the other night, and there was a commercial about bears in captivity and bear biling. You know, and it was so touching. I started crying.
Right.
And the next thing I did, of course, the next day was call up the charity and make a donation.
Great.
Love animals.
Well, also animals can love you. And when you're in when you're in a very dark place, you know, I think.
Absolutely. Bring a great deal of comfort. And there are a few not so nice animals in the music business.
Really?
Oh, yes.
So I need to ask you the $64 million question, which we ask everybody at the end of the Shed Talks interview. If somebody knocked on your door, age 17, 18, 19, 20, and said to you they were really, fed up and they've been diagnosed with bipolar, depression, this and that, and what would you say to them to?
I would say, sit down. I'm going to talk to you. I would say, try not to be frightened. Whatever you do, please go into therapy now. I will also say, don't stop taking your medication, because some bipolar sufferers, they want to get high. And the way to do that is stop taking your medication. You will get high and then you will get low.
Yeah, sure, sure. So, but is there anything else that you might say?
You can indeed live a successful life with bipolar if you work at it.
Very good.
You do have to work at it.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's, from what I've heard, that's totally right. Brilliant.
The one other thing I would say is this. I'm assuming this person is low at this point. When you wake up tomorrow morning, whatever you do, get out of bed, because bed is depression's best friend, and it's also its worst enemy. People lie in bed hiding. It feels safe. It's the opposite. Whatever you do, get out of bed.
Great advice. That's really good. I get that. Get moving. Well, that's great. Well, Nikki, we've come to the end, and I just want to say thanks so much for being such a good sport, getting this program together and waiting and doing but for really being an honest engine, really, because I think, you know, in my humble opinion, that's just what will really help people who are interested in this subject and interested in you. But it's your transparent sort of, right, this is how it's been, this is how it is.
That's the only way to be.
Yeah, well, you're a top rocker. And,
thank you.
I hope that our paths will meet again, cross or whatever.
I'm sure they will. I've enjoyed your company over the Zoom immensely, and I've had a ball.
Brilliant. Absolutely fantastic. Okay, Nick and Jim, we say thank you very, very much. Tip top and tidy. And now we get to the very, very exciting part of the show where we reconnect with Karen Cowan. Karen, hi.
Hi, how are you? Nice to be back again.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you back again. Well, I think that was quite some episode that we've just listened to with Nicky Chin.
It was absolutely marvellous. It was tremendous also for me to listen to because a lot of the music was from when I was a young teenager.
Right.
I really loved it, and I really loved just generally listening to him and his honesty.
Yes, well, let's just stop on the music for a second. So if you had to pick a tune, which one would it be? Would it be Blockbuster? Would it be Tiger Feet? Or you know all those tunes. What was a favourite of yours?
Well, when I was young, it was Tiger Feet.
Right.
And I used to absolutely love it. I used to go berserk dancing to it once, and I knocked over a drum set in a sort of pub. And the next day, my aunt, who I was living with, came back and said, oh, there's a sign outside. Say, anyone see the girl who knocked over the drum set?
Ooh.
And I said, oh, I don't know. And that was during some wild dancing to Tiger Feet.
Well, it's nice to know that there's, you know, synchronicity all around here. So look, let's just kick it off because I don't want to just sound all sort of worshipping and everything of Nicky Chin, but you know, he really was fantastically generous in all of that. And what I thought was a real shock was hearing about, you know, him being at school aged 15, 16 and having the first episode of serious depression, ending up with a diagnosis of manic depression and ending up having electric shock treatment. So what did you think?
I thought that was really quite shocking, you know, to have had ECT. They still don't really know how ECT works even to this very day, but it was pretty shocking to have had it at that age. And I suppose he must have had his parents' permission or something, but yeah, pretty full on to have had that. They must have, I don't know, thought he was really ill, but he also had the narcosis treatment, didn't he?
Yeah, well, what is that exactly? You're put to sleep.
Put to sleep for long periods, yes, in the hope that that will help you get better, yes.
What's the theory about that?
Now, I suppose the theory behind that is that if you get enough sleep and rest, you'll wake up better. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, it's almost like a sort of a virus in your head will go, as it were, and... Yeah.
Yes, through sleep, almost like, you know, put in a coma while the mind heals itself.
Yeah.
Well, as you are sometimes put in a coma for other illnesses.
Oh yes, an induced coma. Yes. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, yeah, got it. You know what I thought with Nicky was that there was almost a sort of element of F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, about him, in the sense he does come from a very wealthy family. And yet, it was almost a cliche to hear that, you know, he never really knew his mum, you know, growing, you know, had a nanny from the get-go, went to boarding school at age 6, and then went to another one at 14. But, you know, that was something that recurred in the chat with him, that lack of love, lack of nurture, lack of affection. What do you think?
Yes, lack of grounding, lack of, feeling grounded, feeling settled, feeling loved. There must have been all sorts of attachment issues, and I would guess that that contributed to his breakdown when he was 16. Yeah, I think the not having a mother and father figure for so long would have made a difference. And it seems in a way that we don't hear much about his mother, but it seems in a way that the way you could connect with your father for Nicky was through success. And it sounds as if the father valued success greatly. And maybe success was equated with love. You know, if you get successful, you get love. And that's what he really needed most of all. And as you know from attachment theory, what small children need most of all is secure love. And Nicky will not have got that, although maybe the Nanny did some valiant work, but it's not your mother and father.
Yeah. When you say, I mean, I just want this clarified, really. When you say secure love, and you talked earlier about grounding, I mean, is there a sort of, you know, easy way to explain what you mean by that?
Well, I suppose the thing about attachment is that if you were lucky enough to be securely attached as a child, you're so loved and cuddled and enclosed emotionally and in every way that you internalise that love and safety. And you're kind of always all right in your life, you know, right, whether anyone likes you, whether you're successful. I mean, a very well securely attached child, I always used to say in practice that if you were really securely attached, you'd be able to sit on a sofa eating grapes for the rest of your life and not care what anyone thought, because right, the very inside of you has been built up correctly with love and security.
Yes. Yes, that's interesting.
John Bowlby, all John Bowlby's work, which is well known on attachment.
Yes. Well, I once met a very, very famous person in music business, managed the biggest groups in the world. And he was a sort of extraordinary, powerful, dynamic person. I asked him what his story was, you know, what drove him. And he said, well, actually, it's a bit weird to tell you, but I was brought up in an orphanage. And it was not a great experience. And that has always, always driven me throughout my life. Well, anyway, it's probably another conversation, but I think it's quite an interesting...
Well, I think, yes, it drives you to all sorts of things that being more highly valued, such as acceptance by others, which would include success. If I'm successful, I'll be accepted,
yes,
therefore loved by others.
Yes.
A constant looking for acceptance, i.e. love.
Yeah, very, very interesting. There's an awful lot in what Nikki talked about. And this, I'm not doing this in order of the conversation, but more of what struck me. He really talked in an incredibly honest way and talked a lot about the importance of honesty. What do you think about that?
I think that honesty is tremendously important in so many ways, perhaps most of all to yourself, because I think the beginning and the core of being all right is understanding and being honest with yourself. And the core of really strong relationships with other people is honesty. And I can see why he's learned over the years, and perhaps what relationships with his family he did have had a degree of honesty. But I think what shines through is that he is now a very honest person. It seems honest with himself. And I think honesty is a sign of a very good mental health. Not easy.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. I mean, he obviously has had a whole lot of serious recurrences in his life and hospitalizations, I mean, much more than many other people I know with this particular condition. But clearly, I think it's in, God, I hope I've got this right. I think it was 1994-95 was a big turning point. And it was three reasons. I'll shut up in a minute.
No. You know,
the first reason was that he met a psychiatrist who said, hello, are you on the wrong medication? Which,
yes.
Which was very interesting to hear about, where he'd been taking lithium, I think, for about 10 years, maybe more. And this psychiatrist said, do you think this has been working?
Yes, exactly. I've had that a lot in, you know, in my practice. I do think it's very important to, I don't think that would have happened nowadays. I hope it wouldn't, but to try different drugs, give them a good chance, but maybe not a 10-year chance of not realising that they're actually not working, but yes.
Well, I thought he was great, actually, because you know, he said, look, you know, I had been taking lithium and now I went on to lamotrigine and valparaite and all this. But that's not to say lithium is a bad thing, you know, and
no,
I really like the way
all.
He said
it
that.
It saves people's lives. Yes, I do too. Yes.
And I thought that, you know, that was really, really good that he said that. Even handed.
Yeah, very even-handed. And of course, yes, lithium is an absolute sort of lifesaver, to put it bluntly, to lots of people. And so is sodium valproate, you know. I'm not a medical person, but you know, you've just got to find the right one, haven't you?
Yeah.
With the right psychiatrist.
And clearly the next bit that he said was the big game changer for him was therapy, going into psychotherapy. And then he talked about being, you know, in part of a much bigger psychoanalysis group, I think. I may have describing this wrong, but that process took he stayed in this group for 9 years. But the point he made was that this was the thing that changed everything for him.
Yes, and I think that's wonderful to say that, and I think, again, rather like he was clear about lithium helps for everybody, he was very, very clear that it's drugs and therapy that help. But I think one point, and it's wonderful that he could do that group and very, very helpful, but one thing I would say, especially in the present NHS crisis, is unfortunately it's very, very difficult unless you have a source of finance to access therapy quickly nowadays. It's worth getting on any waiting lists you can. And unfortunately, you don't want to do this, but if you were in hospital, it's sometimes a bit quicker, but hopefully one wouldn't get to that stage. But I think it's important to note that it is quite difficult. You know, it's not that easy to get therapy if you haven't got money. I mean, you can.
Yes, yes.
But whilst you're waiting, finding a good friend, a space to talk, someone who will just listen to you, just breaks that bubble. Even just phoning the Samaritans.
Yes.
If you're on an NHS waiting list, you know, just somewhere to talk.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's really important, and it's certainly what I believe in, but... I think therapy was available much more. But in a way, you make the point. It's actually, you know, great if you can get it professionally, but even if you can't, then get it with somebody you trust and just talk to somebody and let them, and hopefully you have somebody to listen. So I think that's really great. Did you, just marching back, something that I thought was very entertaining and very moving about what Nicky said was his relationship with Mickey Most, you know, the big record producer, owner of Rack Records and everything. And how...
And his best friend, yeah.
Yeah, and I loved hearing about that. That was almost like he sort of became best friend father figure, I thought.
I think so, very much so. And I wonder whether he was like his father or unlike his father. But I thought it was very interesting that at the end, when he was talking about the films he liked, it was The Sopranos and The Godfather. And I actually am of the generation that knew about Mickey Most. Lots of people who are listening won't. But he was kind of the godfather in those days.
In the music business.
Music business. And everyone was interested in the music business. So everyone knew about Mickey Most. So, you know, it's interesting. Nicky seems quite sort of interested in those kind of godfather type figures.
Yes, well, I agree, and I think, I could have just swum in a swimming pool of the last 15 minutes of that conversation we had with him, because it was really rich, and you know,
really rich,
and he talked about, you know, what the third thing that happened in '95, you know, was he met his future wife, Vanessa, and you know, it's he's like an enthusiast. He's so, you know, and it was like that made such a difference. And of course, it makes a huge difference to
be
all
loved.
Of
us. Yes. Yeah. I was just thinking quickly about Tony Soprano and Don Corleone. You know, in terms of father figures, they were the ultimate protectors and givers of love, weren't they, to their children? Not so much to the outside of the world. But they did show their children intense love.
Yes, well, of course, the thing about Tony Soprano was that he had his therapist, lady therapist, and that was quite funny, actually. I mean, she was a great character, great actress, and his wife was, you know, I said this in the thing, I think the triangle was really, really good. But sort of, you know, moving on to, you know, towards that last 15 minutes, I mean, you know, it obviously his marriage was great and it was a very big success. And, you know, very sad to hear that that ended so, you know, so early. Well, not so early, after 28 years, but whatever. And I thought, again, you know, Nicky Chinn, my goodness me, you know, you are an honest engine to talk about, you know, your wife's death and the alcoholism and everything. And it's almost like he's he'll probably hate me for saying this, but he's almost like a Quaker. He's so honest about that.
Very, very honest, yes. And I'm not sure that what keeps him going, the honesty. I couldn't quite make sense of whether Nicky's wonderful wife was always an alcoholic or whether it was sort of to do with the illness she had. I wasn't quite
all
sure.
All right, yes, yeah. Yes. Yes, I don't actually recall what the illness was.
No, I didn't actually quite catch it. I looked it up. It's MDR. I wondered if it was, but yes.
All right. Okay. Well, we'll have to work on that. But clearly, we must talk about bipolar manic depression. Obviously, we've had a previous guest with that condition, and you know what we have with Nicky is that this is like an odyssey, really. You know, yes. His whole life with 50 hits co-written with Mike Chapman, and then living in Los Angeles. And obviously, I think that was a very tricky moment in his life, actually. You know, when this record company went wrong and Mike Chapman decided to go on a solo thing, and then he was left, you know, and that was obviously something that I guess triggered quite a lot of bad feelings of rejection or abandonment or whatever, being, I don't know, but that's certainly when he became ill again. But I think the great thing with this episode and what Nicky talked about was the power of friendship. I felt that.
I thought that shone through enormously, and his great love of people. I'm not sure where that came from, but I think that there's an underlying theme that he doesn't actually say explicitly, but the his gift for friendship seems to have been something that helped him survive greatly.
Yes.
Friendship with the lead singer of
Sweet.
His friendship with Mickey Most, his friendship with his brothers, in fact.
Yes. Yes, yeah. You know, that's a continual theme that I really liked. And, you know, I think the thing with bipolar, I mean, as we've said earlier, you know, bipolar is the same thing as manic depression is bipolar, is that there are varying degrees of it. I mean,
yes,
I mean, that's
yes,
really what we'd like. Maybe you could just, you know, I think it's good for people because a lot of people really know.
I suppose, yes. I mean, people say nowadays, oh, he's a bit bipolar, or I think I'm bipolar. Well, you would know if you were bipolar, you would definitely know. So there's really sort of three major types of bipolar disorder. One is type one, where you get cycles of depression and then followed often quite quickly afterwards by periods of hypermania, where you might be over-sexualized, overspend, think you're absolutely great, and which then often tips over into mania, which yes. will include psychosis and all sorts of things. And then you might tip down again into depression. You might have plateaus of feeling okay. And type two is the same, but tends not to tip over into mania, the psychosis part of it. So you'd have episodes of depression, episodes of feeling okay, and episodes of hypermania, hypersexualization, shopping, thinking you're absolutely marvelous. I mean, a great site to look at to describe it would be Bipolar UK. And then there's a third category, cyclothymia, which is kind of, no disrespect to people with cyclothymia, a much milder form of it, where perhaps a history of 2 years maybe of cycling moods.
Yes.
So feeling very low, maybe feeling okay, and then feeling high, but to a much lesser degree than the full-on type one and type two bipolar.
And there's one called rapid cycling, isn't there?
Well, you could have rapid cycling cyclothymia. I think that those are sort of under categories, if you see what I mean. There's three main categories, but you could say, if you were kind of diagnosing someone, it's very rapid cycling for him, you know. But very often you go cycle straight from mania to depression. And no wonder, because sometimes if you haven't been lucky enough to have been diagnosed, you can do all sorts of things that would actually add to your depression. So really,
how do you mean? How do you mean?
Well, you might spend too much money. You might, you know,
inappropriate,
have sex with lots of people. You might become very boastful. And your friends who don't know you've got bipolar might think. And then when you get depression, you're dealing with the consequences of all that as well as the depression, none of which is your fault, of course.
Yes.
But that's why diagnosis is so important. And ideally, if it's possible, to have a few people around you who know you and recognise your triggers and so on, and for you to learn to recognise your triggers.
Yes, very important.
Your triggers and your signs. For some people, for depression, the early sign is not picking up the phone. For some people, mania, the early sign is picking up the phone all the time and ringing everyone.
Yes, ringing everybody at 1 o'clock in the morning. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I knew somebody with this who the sign was always that they set up a taxi account and ran up huge bills on having a taxi account, which is quite strange.
Yes. And unfortunately, alcohol and undiagnosed people often have problems with alcohol and tranquilizers because they are trying to self-medicate.
Yes.
They don't know what's going on, so they're trying to self-medicate.
Yes, that's also a very interesting side of Nicky's story, that he drank very heavily. He drank a lot of whiskey in his 20s, and I think when he was having all the success with Mike Chapman. Yet when I asked him that, and I thought, was that, you know, a little bit of rocket fuel on the flames? And he said, no, it wasn't. And he found that, you know, he stopped. I think it was 86. Maybe I've got that wrong, but he stopped drinking pretty well and found that he could. But I've always thought that that was a dangerous bedfellow with this particular condition.
Very dangerous bed. I mean, that would be my opinion. It's a very dangerous bedfellow with bipolar disorder. And he kind of seemed to say that in the end. But I would have thought that maybe his scotch drinking, he knows himself very well. So maybe, you know, he was using it to damp himself down.
Yeah.
Some people use it to damp themselves down rather than, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I understand. Yeah. Well, the two things I just want to finally say, I could understand him, you know, in his early, late teens and early 20s. And he said, oh, you know, my family thought I was a Burke and, you know, a bit of a nightmare. And now what? And so when he had all the success, they were sort of almost, oh, my God, you know, sort of completely, you know, you're not supposed to do that.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very, very interesting. And I'm sure, again, he was very honest. He said, I was became a very arrogant person. But who wouldn't when you had all that success? And it was a hell of a lot. I mean, I don't think people understand how much it was, you know, to have over 50 hit records, you know, you've co-written. I mean, goodness. Anyway, but what I really loved about Nicky at the end was, you know, when he was talking about, we've just heard it, he was talking about music and all of the things he talked about, you know, Wilfred Owen. So it was a great choice. I mean, his father was Welsh, so that was, understand that. But when he likes something, he likes something, and he doesn't sort of sneer or, well, you know, they're quite good. And I love that. And he said, well, the Beatles, what can you say? They were just fantastic. And if they weren't fantastic, they were fantastic, you know.
That was wonderful,
I love that sort of, because lots of people who write themselves are going, well, yeah, they're quite, not bad, you know. John Lennon was quite good. But he was completely, you know, unanimous in his own thinking about that. Now, all of his choices, you know, he's actually a straight shooter, I think. Amidst all this terrible thing, there's all the stuff that's happened to him, he emerges a very straight shooter and a very kind, sort of unselfish person. But that's probably being far too nice to him, but who cares?
Yes, no, I think very much so. And I think one of the things that he was lucky enough to have therapy and to be able to access it himself so well. He obviously used his therapy so well, and he now seems able to enjoy other people even more than he did before, and sort of really, the honesty and the enjoyment of life and the humility.
Yes, absolutely. And what can we say? It was a very, very interesting episode, and there's lots that's going to bear re-listening, and there's lots of food for thought on that, I think. I really do. So
I must say, it's one of the ones that I feel I could talk forever, because so many points came up in it, didn't they?
Yeah. No, they did. And we'd let's end on this one, the word bed and what he said about bed. I really love that. Go on, you say it.
I think he said, whatever you do, get out of bed. And I really agree with that. And of course, Aaron Beck, the great cognitive therapist, would agree with that, that if you can get out of bed, just do something, because every little thing you do or experience, as long as it's not really negative, is likely to lift your mood a little.
Yeah.
But the proviso is that it's my own opinion that sometimes depression is kind of mediated by a lack of sleep or by sheer exhaustion, by the sheer number of negative events you've had to experience. So it kind of needs to be balanced with getting lots of sleep as well as get out of bed, do things, you know. And a lot of my patients often used to say, you suggested I go for a walk. Well, it hasn't made me any better at all. Now, as you say, well, what would you have felt like if you hadn't gone for the little
yes.
walk? It's when you cut yourself off and in bed, even though part of the time it's needed, you're not doing anything that will make you feel the world's a better place.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, I think all of that's really, really well said. And, you know, I think the point is taking action. And sometimes when you can be in bed, you can be immobilized by Hieronymus Bosch, you know,
yes.
people thinking awful, you know, horrible thoughts. And you just, but actually you've just got to pull the lever and get out of bed and get cracking. On
yes.
that note, we're going to say thank you, Karen. Absolutely brill. That was really great, I think. On to the next session, and we're going to hopefully have a bit more frequency on these Shed Talks, because we're going to have some support from a few people, tip top and tidy. And we're going to see you very, very soon. Karen, thank you.
Thank you for letting me be on. It was a great privilege to speak to you and to listen to Nikki, and I shall certainly listen to it again.
Great. All right. Here we go. So it's time for the credits. Lukey Tupman. Great to have you on board, Luke. That's very great. Thank you very much, Bryony, for all your efforts so far. And hopefully you'll still be with us in the future. And everybody else who has contributed to make Shed Talks what it is today. Thank you so much. Be groovy. And onwards and upwards, tip top and tidy.